PRI's podcasts and on-demand audio are free, thanks to contributions from listeners like you. Make a difference. Invest in better media. Contribute at PRI.org. Thank you.
Today in Studio 360, we head to Silicon Valley for a look at a weird and remarkable experiment in video games. A Stanford scientist has designed a new game that looks like Pac-Man, but you play it with living organisms. And a great young country singer revives a country music queen who got real way back in the day.
Imagine, you know, in that day, writing for your good church-going wife and mother of your three kids this song that says, I've had some experience, and sweetheart, you know, I'm going to tell you about it.
Laura Cantrell on the ruckus that Kitty Wells raised in the 1950s. That and lots more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, we'll hear from our resident singer-songwriter Scott Blazek about how hard it is to avoid the vortex of Facebook.
Saw a marriage break up in the tag of a picture. A list of TV shows recited like scripture. Cause it's a heart, and it's a heart, and it's a heart, and it's a heart. So hard to ignore those Facebook walls.
But first, another one of our digital overlords that's pretty impossible to ignore is Apple. Whenever Steve Jobs announces a new product, he's pretty much treated like a rock star.
Thank you very much. It always happens. Thank you.
Even when it's not an actual physical product. That's from the other day with Apple's rollout of its iCloud system. And then the next day, Jobs had a much smaller audience for a different kind of fantastic, futuristic presentation.
And we're very honored to have Mr. Steve Jobs to come here tonight.
Steve Jobs was at a meeting of the City Council of Cupertino in Northern California. He was there to show the design for an all-new Apple headquarters.
And we've come up with a design that puts 12,000 people in one building.
The building would be a giant glass donut, four stories tall and more than a half mile around. Or, as Steve Jobs says...
It's a little like a spaceship landed. But there it is.
For geeks like me, this would be interesting no matter what. It's being designed by one of the world's most celebrated architects, the 76-year-old Sir Norman Foster. But because it's also Apple and also the personal and maybe final design dream of the unstoppable Steve Jobs, it's an event.
It's all really about showmanship. You know, just like his presentations of technology, his design and his architecture are about showmanship.
That is the design writer and curator Phil Patton. He's been thinking about what this building means for Apple and the design legacy of Steve Jobs. Phil, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi.
So the renderings, and we only have renderings, and therefore we can only judge so much for something that isn't built yet, but there is this sort of mythic early, mid-20th century vision of the future about them, right? This silver circular building hovering over a grove in a place called Silicon Valley.
Yes, part spaceship, but also really it boils down to sort of a castle. You're either inside the ring or outside. And all the goodies, that the environmental stuff, the trees, all that's all inside for the members
in
of the Apple
group. In the hole of the donut.
That's right. It is a perfect metaphor for the best and worst of Apple. You know, elegant simplicity, but the problem is sometimes the simplicity comes at the cost of integrating with others or with practicality, like famously the ring-like antenna issue with the iPhone 4.
Well, and it's very modernistic in a kind of old-fashioned sense. I mean, architecture the last 30 years has been sort of about weird angles and strange mutating shapes, where this is smooth and perfect and round.
And yet, you know, anyone who's ever been in a circular building, if you're ever trapped in a circular airport looking for gate 14, you wander around, go to the Hirshhorn Museum, a circular building from the classic modernist period. Circular buildings are, lost. You wander around.
It's utopian, but there's a little bit of dystopia going on in there, maybe.
You're more in that Big Brother ad than out in the audience.
Apple design. I admit I have been for many, many years a complete cultist and sucker for Apple products. What is it about them on a both deep design level and a superficial design level that so seduces so many of us around the world?
Well, what's fascinating is that it's not just the current generation. There's a whole history of it. But the common thing was this elegant simplicity, symbolic, the next computer, a foot-size cube. You know, these exciting kind of symbolic shapes that spoke about the spirituality of technology. And this is what Jobs has understood always. The emotional power implicit in the product makes people feel all the potential.
Well, and there's something as though it seems to take in as influences the kind of popular imagination formed by science fiction and Star Trek and all the rest.
Yes, right. He's delivering the future. And Jobs is very influenced by, like so many of this generation, the 2001 Space Odyssey. Remember the sort of balletic arrival at the donut-shaped Chesley Bonstell, Wernher von Braun wheel-like space station. So the future is round.
Yeah, absolutely.
We know the future is going to be around from that.
And this building, this new headquarters, there's no piece of straight glass in it, apparently, which is apparently very expensive. And I'm reliably told by somebody who's close to Apple that there was tremendous pushback from people even in the company to this project, which is sort of standard Steve Jobs MO, I guess.
Well, you know, the whole history of companies after these things happen is not necessarily good. And if you really look at what is successful about Apple over its history was a streak of rebelliousness. Macintosh was famously developed when Jobs was in semi-exile within the company under the pirate flag, often a architecturally undistinguished portion of the then Apple campus. So once you have this kind of singular organization, you wonder about creativity being possibly staunched.
Is this a building, do you think, from what you've seen, that 20, 50 years from now people will be talking about and caring about?
I think it'd be interesting to see it as a landmark, probably to a period when these companies have very short lives. I mean, look at how we look at the General Motors Tech Center with its styling dome, which was a monument in 1955. The Chrysler Building,
which Chrysler hasn't been in for many, many
years. Right. I mean, it was like 5 years they were there. I mean, building one of these things is risky. You know, you're tempting fate. You know, of course, they build them at the top of their game, but they become monuments to the best things that come in. So, you know, this may be seen as a period to the sentence rather than a semicolon or colon to the future.
Phil Patton, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Phil Patton writes about design for the New York Times, among other publications, and teaches in the Design Criticism Program at the School of Visual Arts. You can see some images of the proposed Apple headquarters at studio360.org. At the video game industry's big annual LA convention that just took place, there was all kinds of buzz, from the excitement about the new Nintendo Wii system to eager anticipation for the R-rated reboot of the Tomb Raider game. But up the coast in Silicon Valley, there is a scientist working on his own approach to taking video games to the next level. He's incorporated living organisms into the games themselves. We sent Lindsay Patterson to a biology lab at Stanford to check it out.
Ingmar Riedel Kruse is a professor at Stanford University.
Okay, so I'm Ingmar Riedel Kruse. I'm assistant professor in bioengineering at Stanford.
He's from Germany, as you might have guessed. He came to the U.S. in 2006, and in 2009, he started his lab at Stanford.
We basically do two things in a lab. One is working on the biophysics of development. We use zebrafish to do that and study how organs form.
The other thing he does in his lab is play video games.
One of the game setups that we use is shown here.
Ingmar probably wouldn't be working at Stanford if he spent his days playing World of Warcraft. It's a little more complicated than that.
This game works with Paramecia. Paramecia are single-celled organisms.
He makes his own games using microorganisms. It started innocently enough.
So this was an afternoon when I saw a Google Doodle. Is it called Google Doodle?
Google Doodles, the special logos Google puts up to celebrate an event. That day was the 25th anniversary of Tetris. He got curious and clicked.
I started reading about the history of video games. This planted the idea if electronics enabled computer games or video games, couldn't biotechnology also enable games?
He's built a few models. The most playable game is called Pac-Mecium, inspired by Pac-Man but played with paramecium, single-celled organisms you might have seen in science lab. They're shaped sort of like a foot and covered in microscopic hairs.
We have similar, as in Pac-Man, a number of dots arranged on the screen. And you now have to try as a player to move your paramecia to collect all these dots. The music is also kind of inspired by 80s type video games.
To get an idea of what the game setup looks like, picture a microscope built by sixth graders. There's a scaffolding made out of Legos holding a webcam with a microscopic lens. The lens peers into a small chamber. That's where the paramecia are. The webcam transmits the action to a laptop screen.
There are four electrodes, which enable us to apply mild electric fields along two axes.
The paramecia aren't getting tasered. They're attracted to the electric field and swim toward it. Using a four-button controller, you can shift the electrical fields to move the paramecia in different directions. You try to keep them away from a chomping yellow fish. This is a computer element.
Many people ask the question whether those paramecia feel pain or not. They don't, because they're single-celled organisms.
Ingmar thinks games like these could be used in schools to get kids more engaged with biology. He published a paper about biotic games early this year, and probably no one was more excited than Patrick Scott Patterson. He's the official world record holder on several versions of Pac-Man. He goes by Scott.
If it wasn't for Pac-Man, who knows when I would have discovered video games.
It was the first game Scott ever played.
It was just something, especially at that young of an age that I was, that I felt like I was in control of. I was the youngest cousin. I was an only child. You know, I couldn't play against my older cousins in a game of football or something. I was too little. I could go into a video arcade at, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, and I could beat the pants off of the 17, 18, 19-year-old that had just put a high score up and thought he was something special. Some people say, oh, man versus machine and stuff like that. I always still looked at it as man versus man.
And it's still man versus man. Ingmar, the inventor of Pac-Mecium, was pretty much the unchallenged champion. But no one outside of his lab had actually played it.
It's this lab right
this
here.
Right here? All right.
Hello.
Hello.
It's a pleasure meeting you.
Yeah, it's nice to meet you too, man. I'm glad to be out here, dude. This is exciting.
Hello. Welcome. Do you want to see the game? Do you want to...
Yeah, I want to see the game. I even see you get the sign up on the wall right there with the Pac-Man-like characters on it. You're paying some homage to the old Pac-Man. So yeah, I'm excited. I want to see the game, man.
Just to show you, you see the white stripes moving around.
Yeah.
Those are paramecia, single-celled organisms.
Try to bring them. Ingmar's got a few strategy tips to share with Scott.
Before the actual game starts, when it counts in, I try to already move them around. And if I push them in all four directions continuously, then they start swirling towards a compact mat.
He's thought about it more than he let on. See, I can tell this from that. He's talking like a gamer now. And these guys don't corner. Don't corner real well. Yeah, it's more like I'm guiding them rather than instructing them. Figure out what they're, you know, how do they like to move? What's the most efficient way to move them?
Scott's warmed up, and the moment has arrived.
So who should go first?
It's your lab, man.
Okay. So we each play one game? Is that fair enough?
That and works whoever, for me. Whoever Do else. Or die.
Ingmar starts off strong, but at the end of every level, it's hard to direct the Paramecia toward the last dot on the screen. It takes him about 5 minutes to finish his game.
Okay, so 1,480 points.
Do you think you can beat that score?
Well, it's going to depend on how much these guys want to cooperate.
Scott tries to steer them off the screen when the fish shows up, but they're not the speediest things on Earth.
Ah! I was hoping that the fish wasn't going to go up into that section up there, because either you had some lazy paramecia or whatever that other, you know, dirt or whatever it was, but that did it. He went up there. He was gonna wipe me out, man.
What's your score?
1355, and he put up 1480. So pretty close, but not close enough.
Scott's confidence is unshaken. With more practice time, he says he could conquer in a rematch. But he's still psyched to be the first gamer to try something new.
If you took a Call of Duty or something and took it back in time and showed somebody, they wouldn't believe that was possible. It's interesting to me from not just from the scientific perspective and stuff, but it's like a lot of parallels between what you're doing here and how video gaming started out. Mm. Not too far from here. Who knows, you know, 20 or 30 years from now. This idea could take. It blows my mind to think about it.
So should we talk again in 20 years?
All right, yeah, deal. We'll shake on it right now.
For Studio 360, I'm Lindsay Patterson.
Why is that so interesting to me? Maybe because a century from now, when computers run the world and we're their funny performing pets, Pacmesium is sure to look like a very prescient artifact. Meanwhile, you can see a video of its creator showing off the game at studio360.org. Coming up, girls who admit having sex before they're married? In the 1950s? In country music? Who knew?
That's the underlying key to the whole thing. It's not that the topic was initially broached
right.
in the song, but
people loved it.
People loved it, and it sold a ton of records.
On her new album, Laura Cantrell channels the groundbreaking but forgotten country superstar Kitty Wells. That's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
You're in the arms of another, where you've no right to be.
In the 1950s, a generation before Loretta and Tammy and Dolly became household names in America, the biggest female star in Nashville, she was actually called the Queen of Country Music, was a woman named Kitty Wells. She performed at the Grand Ole Opry wearing the demure gingham dresses women were supposed to wear, and everything about her seemed Bible Belt wholesome. But Kitty Wells revolutionized what a woman could sing about.
The love in your eyes, dear, for me has grown dear.
The singer-songwriter Laura Cantrell is about the age of Kitty Wells' granddaughter, and her new record is a top-to-bottom tribute to Wells. It's called Kitty Wells Dresses, and Laura Cantrell is in Studio 360 today, along with her band. And we're going to start off with one of the Kitty Wells songs that you play on this record, one of her tunes that caused such a ruckus back then. It's called I Don't Claim to Be an Angel.
two, three.
Laura Cantrell and her band playing I Don't Claim to Be an Angel, which is on this new record, Kitty Wells Dresses. So that song seems so unbelievably frank for the 1950s, for a country hit in the 1950s. This person, this woman saying, I had sex with people and I have a terrible past, but, you know, maybe you'll marry me anyway or maybe you won't. Was that a controversial thing when it was released?
You know, I think after the controversy of It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels, which
are your huge hit.
Right, was a huge hit. I think that that in a way it just opened the doors enough that you could say things that were frank but that were in a language that was, you know, sort of respectable enough.
Slightly oblique.
Yes, yeah, slightly oblique. It always really struck me how, you know, if you really looked into the song, how candid it really was,
yeah,
and how it just kind of got through without being a controversy because the fuss had already blown over by the time this song came out because of the big, you know, ruckus that it wasn't God who made Honky Tonk Angels had caused.
And give the listeners a sense of the ruckus that that did cause.
Well, that came out in 1952. It was an answer song to a hit of the day called The Wild Side of Life, where a man's sort of lamenting his wife is running around in the honky tonks and won't come home. And so he sort of blames God and says, I didn't know that God would do this to me. And, you know, Kitty, in her version, which, of course, the song itself was written by a man from down in Louisiana, she says in the lyrics of the song, which she'd sung so kind of read so beautifully, like really straight, but, you know, it wasn't God who made Honky Tonk Angels. Don't blame all of women for what, you know, is happening in your marriage.
It wasn't God who made Honky Tonk Angels, as you said in the words of your song. Too many times married men think they're still single. That has caused many a good girl to go wrong.
You know, there was a moment where they thought, well, maybe we should try to kind of squelch this, you know, and we'll ban it. In fact, it did get banned from the nationally syndicated portion of the Grand Ole Opry. She couldn't perform it on that part
of
the show.
But the horse was kind of out of the barn,
right? It was gone. The horse was charging out down the in the fields. No, it was a huge hit. It was a jukebox hit. It was everywhere for a while. I think that's kind of the underlying key to the whole thing. It's not that the topic was initially broached in the song, but
people loved it.
People loved it, and it sold a ton of records. So from there, they actually, you know, Johnny Wright, Kitty Wells' husband, wrote I Don't Claim to Be an Angel. Imagine, you know, in that day, writing for your good church-going, you know, wife and mother of your three kids this song that says, I've had some experience, and sweetheart, you know, I'm going to tell you about it.
And you grew up listening to her. I mean, your father played her records, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. And my dad's family, they were big Opry listeners, and Kitty was their girl. It's, you know, something that I kind of knew firsthand how important she was to them.
And when you were a teenager in the 1980s, did you feel the need or urge to reject that, or were you always fine with it? Did you ever go through a I'm not a country music girl thing?
I think every teenager in Nashville rebels against it at some point because it is so ubiquitous down there. You know, once you outgrow the sort of teenage rebellion of just rejecting it because it's there, for me at least, I realized it was something important to me. And, you know, I have grandparents that were square dancers and, you know, really into, you know, just the sort of experience of it.
One of my earliest memories is going with my parents to square dances in little towns. So I know that feeling.
Yep. So, you know, it's something that part, you know, once you outgrow the sort of teenage rebellion of just rejecting it because it's there, for me at least, I realized it was something important to me that I wanted to find out more about and explore.
Is Kitty Wells aware of this record?
Oh, yes, she is. I actually got a really wonderful chance to visit with her last summer when we were finishing mixing it. And it was very sweet for me because I'd written this song for her and I got to see her response to it. She and Johnny both, her husband, were very, very sweet and positive about it. And then when I explained to them I'd actually made a whole record in her honor, what was interesting to me was that they really just were curious about what songs I'd chosen and which ones were my favorites. And then as I explained to them, you know, why I'd picked certain songs, they just started singing them to me, you know, ones that they remembered.
Oh.
So it was so,
what a
so
wonderful
sweet
moment.
Yeah, it was really like if we got, you know, no further than that moment, that would have been, you know, the pot of gold right there.
And that one original song that you played for her is Kitty Wells' Dresses.
That's right.
Which, why don't you play that now?
Great.
One, two, three.
So neat.
Laura Cantrell performing Kitty Wells Dresses, which is also the title of her new record. And backing you up are Jeremy Chatsky, Mark Spencer, John Graboff, and Kenny Kosick. Kitty Wells Dresses. Do you feel like doing this record of her songs and then this song about her is sort of like some virtual dress-up game with her you're playing?
Well, I definitely will say that I, you know, was referring to a lot of things with the title of the record and with the idea of the dresses and the clothes that she wore. And certainly when I was learning to play this music myself, Kitty's music was easy to try on. You know, it was pretty direct, straightforward. The arrangements were simple. It was a great starting place. So there was a sort of virtual trying on of her style. And I also just have always been fascinated with the image that the women had at that time, because it was obviously a kind of enforced sweetness and
frilliness.
Yeah, frilly and non-threatening and not too, you know, pretty but not too sensual. This idea that the whole show being presented had to be wholesome in a way.
Well, it reminds me very much of the modern princessy thing that little girls are kind of obliged to buy into today. Mm-hmm. And you have a little girl, yes?
I do. I have a 5-year-old and she loves those princesses. And in fact, when we were working on the photos for Kitty Wells Dresses, I came home one day with a big pile of gingham and Bella just thought it was the most exciting. She wanted me to try on all those frilly dresses. So there was a built-in appeal for the little girls.
And when she comes home in a couple of years singing Taylor Swift songs, how will that go down with Mom?
Oh, that'll be just fine with me. It's funny because she's also already very aware what songs are mine. And one day she stopped me and she said, "Are you writing that song, Mama?" And I said, "Yes, I am, Bella." She said, "You must really like Kitty Wells." So it's an interesting, you know, even at a young age, you know, she's been aware of me kind of trying on this stuff for my own purposes.
Laura Cantrell, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
You can see Laura and her band performing another song in our studio at our website, studio360.org. Coming up, the heroine of a wonderful, funny new novel is the perfect narrator, because she writes all her town people's obituaries.
I still use a manual typewriter, a 1953 Underwood portable in a robin's egg blue. Without slapping the return or turning the cylinder to release the paper with a sharp whip, without all that minor havoc, I feel I've paid no respect to the dead. What good is an obituary if it can be written so peaceably, so undisturbingly, in the dark of night?
My conversation with the great Great Plains novelist Timothy Shaffer, that's in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Don't go away. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. I just read a new book called The Coffins of Little Hope, the fourth novel by Timothy Shaffer. Shaffer is now the master of a kind of Great Plains Gothic, by turns funny and moving, charming and odd, all with a dead-on sense of the American Midlands. I grew up in Nebraska, and the story is set in Nebraska. My first job at age 17 was writing obituaries for my hometown newspaper, and the novel's narrator is the obituary writer for her local paper. She's Essie Miles, 83 years old.
I still use a manual typewriter, a 1953 Underwood portable in a robin's egg blue, because the soft pip, pip, pip of the typing of the keys on a computer keyboard doesn't quite fit with my sense of what writing sounds like. I need the hard metal clack. And I need those keys to sometimes catch so I can reach in and untangle them, turning my fingertips inky. Without slapping the return or turning the cylinder to release the paper with a sharp whip, without all that minor havoc, I feel I've paid no respect to the dead. What good is an obituary if it can be written so peaceably, so undisturbingly, in the dark of night? Though my name does not begin with an S, my byline has always been S. Miles, because I'm Esther, but more often Essie or S, and thus capital S, just S, no period, on the page.
That's Lois Smith reading from The Coffins of Little Hope. One of the novel's main plots concerns a little girl, a missing girl named Lenore. Her mother says she was abducted, but some people in the town think she never existed at all. It's a mystery that the author, Timothy Shaffer, never entirely resolves.
And I knew early on that I didn't want to write a missing child comedy or even, you know, a satire.
Although there haven't been many of those missing child comedies.
Right. They're kind of hard to market, I'm sure. But I did want to kind of sort of examine how we as a culture will build pilgrimage, essentially, and shrines to things that have roots in turmoil and crisis. And so, and I guess it's not the most original plot. I mean, I think I was thinking about it after that Jodie Foster movie where she gets on a plane with her daughter and then the daughter disappears. But I wanted to play with that a little bit in the book and to have those questions arise, not just for the characters in the book, but possibly for the reader as well.
On this girl, we pinned all hopes of our dying town's salvation. The longer we went without seeing her even once, the more and more dependent upon her we grew. She became our leading industry, her sudden nothingness a valuable export, and we considered changing the name of our town to hers. We would live in the town of Lenore. Is it any wonder that we refused to give up hope despite all the signs that she'd never existed, that she'd never been anybody? Never, not even before she supposedly vanished?
When I started this story, I actually didn't even really know who the narrator was. I mean, I knew, I was thinking I wanted a kind of collective first person, like one of my favorite stories, A Rose for Emily by William Faulkner, in which you had a character who wasn't necessarily speaking for herself, but speaking on behalf of the community. Mm-hmm. But I didn't get too far into it before the narrator actually did assert herself as an individual. And so once she did, and once I figured out that she was this obituary writer who was 83 years old, had spent her life writing about death, and had some sort of ironic perspective on the fact that she's now towards the end of her own life, then things really did sort of start to fall into place as she was concerned about the newspaper that she worked for, which was struggling, and as she was concerned about this farm woman and the effect of this missing child on their community, as the community itself is trying to keep alive.
Your last novel, which was set among sophisticated yuppies in Omaha, I can imagine how you inhabited those characters more easily. This 80-something-year-old woman in a small town, was that a particular challenge to sort of figure out her voice, really kind of inhabit her for 5 hours a day?
You know, it wasn't. I thought that I should interview 83-year-old women. I thought I should maybe interview obituary writers. But the more I wrote about her, the more I wrote in her voice, I really did feel like I just needed to get in her skin and sort of get into character like an actor would. And I think that felt the most natural.
What will you most remember? It's a question I've asked of the grieving hundreds and hundreds of times. The people I ask almost always take a deep breath and exhale. What will I remember? They most always say, looking up and off as they're thinking back. Their first responses, which come too quickly, simply to fill the silence in the room, are unexceptional. Her infectious smile, his playful wink, her bubbly laugh, his gruff demeanor, which disguised his sweet, soft heart. But here's what I do. I write nothing down. I give them absolutely nothing, as if they've not yet said a word. I sit, my skinny legs crossed beneath my long skirt, my steno pad atop my knee, the point of my pen pressed on the paper but not moving, not even to doodle. They know that I know that they can do better than that. To please me, then, they see past their grief and breathe vivid life back into their beloveds in idiosyncratic detail.
Well, one of the things you do beautifully with her, it seems to me, is not impose upon her a, you know, 39-year-old man's idea of the generic elderly lady. She's a human being and not just this cute little old lady.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, she's opinionated and she knows the community and she's kind of a one-woman Greek chorus, I guess, is how I imagined her. She's chronicling the deaths of this community and she's perhaps the one person who knows everything. And so you really, well, you took the pulse of the community by looking at not just who was dead, but you also got a sense of who was surviving them. And it resulted in a kind of communication of an oral history sitting at the dinner table.
Right. Small towns exist in the popular American imagination as, on the one hand, icons of homey, cute, morning in America, Edens. Also, especially in the last 40, 50 years, as these places of bleakness and alienation and loneliness and scariness and crime. You know, I think of the movie Badlands or the real-life murder of the transsexual kid in Nebraska that became the Hillary Swank movie. Your books, interestingly to me and charmingly to me, sort of seem to see both of those sides of small-town middle America.
Well, yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem all that sunny to me, but at the same time, it's not bleak and despairing. I mean, my family still lives on the farm. I still return to small town Nebraska frequently, and I teach in Lincoln, which is not too far from nowhere, basically. But, I mean, I had the sense growing up that I needed to get out, that everything is happening elsewhere. But then when I started writing about Nebraska is when I returned to it after having left it several years. And you realize that all these things that you were seeing that you took for granted are amazing.
And it's also a setting and a place in all of its senses, the places you write about, the people you write about, that is relatively untrodden territory these days in mainstream fiction, especially done in the way you so wonderfully do it, in this witty, weird, kind of non-portentous way.
Oh, yeah. And it's definitely filtered through my own kind of perverse imagination, I guess. I mean, it's not the landscape that Willa Cather would describe, even though it's literally the same landscape in some cases. I mean, I remember reading places that I was familiar with, rivers that I knew, and actually my town that I grew up outside of Aurora. And so it was legitimizing in a sense, I guess.
For
and
sure.
Kind of profound to discover that I could actually write about this place that I knew, that people actually cared about. You know, I think when you grow up in the Midwest, you have this debilitating sense of modesty, which, you know, that nobody would be interested.
When you drive out through those endless, peopleless plains, whether or not they're broken down farms, but just the general plains, Nebraska landscape, are you more often inspired, feel like you're listening to Aaron Copland, or are you also spooked and depressed? I feel both, depending on, I don't know, my mood otherwise.
Well, sometimes it can be so vast and empty, you know, that it can be startling. And you do get the sense of what the pioneers must have felt, or the homesteaders, when they attempted to come here and to grow things in this earth that was kind of rebelling against them. But, you know, just to go back to the farm that I grew up on, I mean, it's constantly changing, and it feels like it's a story that's never going to finish being told. You know, it takes on new character all the time. A couple of years ago, a tornado swept through and destroyed some of the structures on the farm. Fortunately, nothing major, but it took out a lot of trees, and it was emotional to see those changes and to see this familiar property really slightly changed, but in a way vastly changed. And so I think that for me, I'm always going to be returning to that farm to try to get to the bottom of something, I guess. I don't know, some connection that I feel.
Timothy Shaffer, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Timothy Shaffer is the author of The Coffins of Little Hope. I asked him what the first line of his obituary would be when he dies. The answer is on our website.
When you wake up, feel
So now, your turn. Go to studio360.org or our Facebook page and tell us yours. How would you like the first line of your obituary to read? One sentence only, please, and in the coming weeks, I'll read our favorites on the air. And speaking of Facebook, how much time did you spend there today? Or maybe the question should be, how much of your day has been irretrievably sucked away by Facebook? Studio 360's resident folk singer Scott Blazek has gotten a little lost in that world.
Where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Oh, where have you been, my darling young one? Been jumping through windows and tabs of my browser. Been deep in that news feed for hundreds of hours. What did you see, my blue-eyed son? Oh, what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a frat boy, his hair was just frosted. Saw a pregnant belly, it made me disgusted. Saw a marriage break up in the tag of a picture. List of TV shows recited like scripture. I saw an ex-boyfriend, he's got a new girlfriend. I saw a co-worker, she tried to cook chicken. Saw the rants of a fan raging at the referees. Bachelorette party in the back room of an Applebee's. Cause it's a heart, but it's a heart, but it's a heart, and it's a heart, so hard to ignore those Facebook walls. Oh, what do you do now, my blue-eyed son? And what do you do now, my darling young one? Logging back in for my profile's inactive. I'll upload a photo that makes me look attractive. I'll like a few songs, I'll dislike some others. I'll flirt with a girl who's friends with my brother. I love it and watch it and live it and read it. I'll update my status for all friends to tweet it. I'll write on them walls till my fingers are broken. I'll RSVP for a potluck in Oakland. Cause it's a heart, but it's a heart, but it's a heart. It's a hard, so hard to ignore those Facebook walls.
You can see a music video for Scott Blazek's song at studio360.org. And that is it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Michael Guerriero,
Sarah D'Elia,
Sean Twigg,
Rachel Greenberg,
Katie Bierenbaum,
Liz Viella.
Lois Smith read the excerpts from The Coffins of Little Hope. Special thanks this week to George Wellington and, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, what happens when a gospel star goes pop?
The whole reason I did this album was to bridge a gap, to stop this limitation. What people don't know can limit them.
Kim Burrell takes a risk on good old-fashioned love songs. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.